this whole minerals deal that is dangled in front of Trump is bait. And that this bait is offered for one reason and one reason only, in order to make sure that the United States recommits to Ukraine and that it provides a security guarantee for the Zelensky government or whatever new government Ukraine might have aligned with the West. Because, you know, to defend these deals, you need to make sure that the government in Kiev honors them. So who knows what was signed, but we know that BlackRock is in there. We know that the Brits signed the 100-year partnership, and that the whole point of this is basically to continue plunder and pillage of Ukraine's wealth. But if the government in Kiev realigns with Russia, they might tear up all these deals, and they might have good grounds to tear it up because, for example, the 100-year partnership with Great Britain, which apparently included a secret appendix, which basically transfers the bulk of natural resource wealth and infrastructure and industries of Ukraine to British interests.
Alex Craner, good morning to you. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Andy. Good to be with you again.
It's always really good to be with you. And a lot of stuff is hitting the news, and it's hard for me to read the global chessboard here. Let's start with Ukraine, the U.S. It looks like we are about to, or maybe we even have signed a deal for their natural resources over there. What's going on with that, and how does the tension, or is there still tension with Russia and Putin with all of this?
So, Andy, okay, I'm not sure whether the deal was signed or not. You know, I got information that it was signed, but I also read a report last night that some kind of a snag happened and the signing was delayed again, which, you know, I wasn't surprised about that, but the news that it was signed did surprise me a little bit. Why? Because I think that this whole minerals deal that is dangled in front of Trump is bait. And that this bait is offered for one reason and one reason only, in order to make sure that the United States recommits to Ukraine and that it provides a security guarantee for the Zelensky government or whatever new government Ukraine might have aligned with the West. Because, you know, to defend these deals, you need to make sure that the government in Kiev honors them. So who knows what was signed, but we know that BlackRock is in there. We know that the Brits signed the 100-year partnership and that the whole point of this is basically to continue plunder and pillage of Ukraine's wealth. But if the government in Kiev realigns with Russia, they might tear up all these deals and they might have good grounds to tear it up because, for example, the 100-year partnership with Great Britain, which apparently included a secret appendix, which basically transfers the bulk of natural resource wealth and infrastructure and industries of Ukraine to British interests, were signed by Volodymyr Zelensky on the 16th of January of this year, and his presidential mandate expired on the 5th in May of 2024, about 7 or 8 months before that. So it may be that, you know, Keir Starmer signed a 100-year partnership with a private person in Ukraine. At any rate, you know, a different government might interpret this in this way, and they would have Ukraine's constitution on this side because the Ukraine's constitution says the presidential mandate is 5 years, not a day longer, and that the presidential elections cannot be delayed for any reason whatsoever. And then, you know, we had Boris Johnson in Kiev in February, who was pretty much explicitly saying that unless the United States provides security guarantee, then not a penny of these investments can flow westwards. So this is where I think that the whole boondoggle is about making sure that the United States continues to support Ukraine, that is, Western aligned government in Ukraine, and that it does so with its own troop, with its own military power. The reason why I very much doubt that Trump is enthused about this at all is a few things. First of all, the deal that they're being offered is, let's say that initial versions of the deal were basically unacceptable. It was something very, very vague. And the reason is obviously because if you signed everything over to British interest, then you can't also sign it over to the US. And so Zelensky's playing some kind of a three-card monte directed by his, you know, by his handlers over in London. The second reason is because if the United States has to provide the security guarantee, then the United States is running the risk of a military conflict against Russia, which is, you know, has escalatory dominance. It's a nuclear power, so it's the downside is practically unlimited. The upside is the, you know, whatever cat in the bag the London interests are willing to concede. And then the third reason is because the bulk of what's valuable in Ukraine is already under Russian control. The Donbas in Ukraine has, before the war, the Donbas accounted for about 80% of Ukraine's GDP. So that's, you know, that's where most of the coal reserves are, natural gas reserves, and other resources, most of it. So that's already under Russian control. So, you know, whatever's left in the rest of Ukraine is less than that. And then, you know, the Russians, for their part, have made the offer to the Americans that they're welcome to join them in developing and exploiting these resources on a mutually agreed basis. And not only that, but, you know, Russia itself has between 75 and 90 trillion dollars worth of natural resources itself, about which we welcome American companies to come and join us to develop all this. And in that case, there's no downside, because the Russians are already providing the security. And so I think this situation is clear enough that I don't see any reason other than politics why Donald Trump would have to hesitate even for a second between these two deals. And, you know, he does frequently say that he trusts Vladimir Putin. We know that Putin has said, hey, the door is open, we can work together, we can offer you much, much more lucrative deals than the Ukrainians can, and no risk of war between us, you know. There's a lot of upside and no downside, whereas, you know, if you provide security for the best benefit of British and French interests, then there's limited upside and very, very unlimited downside. So that would also explain why Zelensky has been playing this strange game and delaying the signing of the deal, even though he desperately needs the United States on its side. It's really surreal that the man whose government and whose probably his physical life depends on Donald Trump. We go to the White House in February and insult Donald Trump to his face. It's very, very strange. And the only, to me, the only explanation for this is that he's not, you know, his loyalties lie in London, not in, you know, not with the United States or with Ukraine. Go ahead.
Yeah, pragmatically speaking, and this is just pragmatically, why would Donald Trump do any deal with Ukraine when Russia has all the assets or most of the assets of Ukraine? And I'm saying this not as a humanitarian, but pragmatically speaking, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, so I'll make the assumption, and it's a guess, you know, I could be wrong, but I'll make the assumption that whatever deal the United States ends up signing with Zelensky, or if they already signed it, that the Russians will honor it. That is, they will say, we're taking over Kiev. We're taking over Ukraine. You know, not necessarily the whole territory, but, you know, even if the military campaign stops at the four regions, and they don't go to Dnieper, and that they don't take the whole territory of Ukraine militarily, they will take it over administratively. That is, they will make sure that the next government in Kiev is aligned with Russia, that they bring Ukraine back into its orbit. And in order to avoid a conflict with the United States, I think that the Russians will probably make the choice of honoring the deal that Trump signs with Zelensky, to say that, okay, whatever you got from there, we're going to make sure you get that. There's no need for us to go to war over this. And so that's my guess. And the reason why I'm comfortable making that guess is because it avoids the risk of nuclear confrontation between the two superpowers. And it's over business anyway. You know, somebody's going to do that business. May as well be American companies on a, you know, mutually beneficial basis. Why not?
So you would be just pragmatically, that's really what it just makes the most sense.
You know, that makes sense. Yeah. It makes sense to me for sure. Now, whether this is what's been happening between Trump and Putin via Witkoff and whatever, we're guessing because we don't know. But, you know, I gather these snippets where Trump is practically insisting that he trusts Putin, right? Mm-hmm. He doesn't trust Zelensky. He doesn't trust the Europeans. He doesn't trust Starmer. He trusts Putin. And then also, I think just yesterday in an interview, he said that Ukraine was going to be crushed in a very short time. You know, this is a new thing, you know, that assessment is new. He hasn't said that before. Mm-hmm. So if that is the idea, that means that Russians are going to be taking over. And so, you know, this scenario makes sense to me, but, you know, only time will tell. We'll learn as time goes by. But, you know, we also see the Europeans quite in a frenzy over all of this. It's just completely insane how the Europeans are coping with this.
I want to hear about that, and that was really my next question. Where does Europe fit in all of this? Where's the UK, and then also where does China fit in all of this, if you would? Because it seems like, again, this is all about natural resources.
Yes. Okay. So, the British have a catastrophic fiscal situation at home. Their economy is in a deep structural recession. I don't see what the light at the end of the tunnel might be for Britain. And in fact, you know, there's talk about Britain sitting at an explosive social mix that might erupt in a civil war. I think that the the 100-year partnership that Keir Starmer signed with Zelensky in January was potentially that light at the end of the tunnel, because they would use that as collateral to then run a credit expansion boom in the United Kingdom, and then, you know, hopefully revamp the economy. But it looks like that's not happening. Europeans, same thing, you know. The Starmer's sidekick, Emmanuel Macron, has been fantasizing about getting in on the reconstruction of Ukraine. You know, they were, the idea was to, for France, for French banks, to use the Russian assets frozen on in Europe, in European banks, as collateral to finance the reconstruction of Ukraine. And then that would be a huge bonanza for French banks and French corporations and big business in Ukraine and so on and so forth. But again, you know, only if you have security guarantee, only if somebody will guard the fort for you there. That doesn't seem to be happening. And it seems to me that the Europeans were completely unprepared for the eventuality that they would no longer have U.S. support. And I think that they're in complete disarray now. And I don't see that they know what they're doing at all. You know, the easy part is to say, okay, we're going to allocate trillions of euros into defense industries, because, you know, that you can control that, that can go through the central planning process and so forth. But it's you're actually investing huge amounts of money that you don't have into producing goods for destruction. So, you know, you're gonna kind of refloat the economy through one credit cycle, and then it's going to collapse. There's no way about this. It's mathematical. And, you know, I don't see how Europe gets beyond this. I think that what's going to happen is that European Union is going to disintegrate along with NATO. And I think that then the sobering up process will be one country at a time, you know, forging bilateral relationships with Russia, with their neighboring countries and so forth, and hopefully averting World War III, because it seems to me that as far as London and Paris are concerned, and, you know, and Brussels and Berlin and Warsaw and so on, they're gung-ho for war against Russia. And they already have the date, 2029, 2030. That's when they're ready to do it. The people in Europe have other ideas. And then as a result, we have this increasingly heavy-handed repression. You know, I heard a story out of Germany, which has now had six consecutive quarters of contraction, that, you know, there was in some town in Germany, the military came to a high school with a recruitment drive. And the students responded with, you know, they put on a placard that said, "Education, not bombs." And they sent the police to disperse the students, and they all got a 3-week suspension from school as a reward for their troubles. So that's, you know, that's very heavy-handed for kids, just saying, "Give us education, not war." I mean, that's not even, you know, that's not even hate speech remotely. That should be applauded and commended, and instead they got punished just like that. So it's not difficult to imagine that maybe a few years down the road, we might have a situation like in Ukraine, where, you know, you have these thugs with vans pulling people off the street and forcing them into the military to fight wars. You know, back to the 1930s, you know, the way Germany was then under Hitler could be Germany in the future unless, you know, a different political faction wins out, like AfD. If we get the CDU-CSU with people like Friedrich Merz and other merry band of bankers, we're in serious trouble in Europe.
So I would absolutely agree with you. I think the EU is on the verge of collapsing and will collapse, if you would. I don't know exactly what that looks like. Do you see, let's say, like starting with Germany being that regional superpower or continuing? Or do you see Russia having dominance over the entire region? Do you see some of these countries, especially in the eastern part? And I just, for candor, I have family in the eastern part. Then my wife is flying over there in June. But do you see those countries being even absorbed again, like it was during the Cold War?
I don't see that, Andy. I think that Russians are not terribly interested in dominating Europe anymore. Russia dominating Europe, Eastern Europe, you know, the Warsaw Pact bloc, was basically a reaction to the formation of NATO. So, you know, we go back to 1946. The war had practically just ended, right? And the Soviet Union was in alliance with the United States and Great Britain, right? And they just beat the Nazis together. So they should have been allies. In 1946, Winston Churchill gives his Fulton speech, and he says Soviet Union is an enemy. And by this time, the FDR is gone. You have Harry Truman there. Harry Truman, I mean, you know, the guy who dropped two nuclear bombs on Japan, right? And so by 1949, they create NATO. And then, what was it, 1951? I don't know. They added Turkey and Greece. And then 1952, they add Western Germany, right? And so now they're against Russia's sphere of influence. It was only then, in 1952, that the Soviet Union reacted and created a countervailing bloc, the Warsaw Pact. It's not that the Russians took control of Eastern Europe completely in isolation from, it was a reaction to the West building up a hostile bloc at their doorstep. I don't think, you know, I don't think that Russians are terribly interested in ruling over hostile populations, because, you know, if they tried to impose their hegemony over Poland, the Baltic states, Finland, Romania, Bulgaria, it would be a burden. It would be going back to the dark ages of the Soviet Union. I don't think Russians are very, very interested in that. They're more interested in multipolar integrations, in Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, in building up the BRICS movement, in bringing their presence to the global south, to Africa, to South America and so forth, and doing business with those nations rather than policing hostile Eastern Europeans. So I don't think that's really a risk. But at the same time, you know, that's the rallying cry of the Europeans who are desperate for war against Russia. So they're saying, oh, gosh, as soon as they defeat Kiev, as soon as they defeat Ukraine, next they're going to be going to the Baltic states, to Finland, to Poland, and who knows, maybe, you know, maybe Paris and London that next. This is pure fear-mongering based on nothing. There isn't a single Russian official who has expressed any territorial pretensions against any European country. So this is just fomenting fear and hysteria in order to build up to a war that the Europeans still desperately want. I think that the prospect of such a war is now so repugnant to European populations that you see the result in all these elections where people are increasingly favoring if not pro-Russian side, definitely anti-war side of the political spectrum. And then you also see the reaction by the establishment that doesn't want to let the war die. They're starting to cancel elections around Europe. And I think that the polarization is building up to a breaking point where, you know, I can't imagine how this is going to take place, you know, but I can only answer your question with it's already happened before, you know. And I think that maybe in the same way the Soviet Union disintegrated, Europe will integrate along those lines as well.
No, I think that's a good, really good answer. And pragmatically speaking, I don't see a whole lot of wisdom in occupying Eastern Europe or just Europe in general, with the exception of the Baltic states and the Nordic countries. There's no natural resources there, correct me if I'm wrong. So, and then you have a population, and rightfully so, that doesn't want to be occupied. So why would you do any of that? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. What makes a lot of sense is for Russia to develop relationships south of them in China, which has a huge manufacturing base, a huge economy, second largest economy in the world, as well as going into Africa, meaning diplomatically with all of the natural resources there. So that's my two cents.
Well, okay, but you see, there is one problem, is that Russia could be provoked into wars of this sort, because there's a Russian minority in Latvia and Lithuania and in Estonia. And, you know, these populations are being increasingly treated in a similar way as Russian-speaking populations in Ukraine are being treated. You know, they're not killing them yet, but they are building up pressures. And I think that the idea is, you know, you always use these minorities to provoke a conflict. Sudeten Germans in Czechoslovakia in 1938, 37 and 38, is how we got the Nazis to invade Czechoslovakia. It was all contrived, it was all faked, but this is what is done. The war in former Yugoslavia was started basically by fear-mongering the Serbian minorities in Croatia against the Croatian government. You know, they were told, oh, you know, the Croatians are going to come and slaughter you all, so you have to resist and arm, and this is what happened, and then it escalates from there. So, you know, there is a risk that these scenarios might play out, and that they might force the Russians to intervene. And then, you know, the Western Europe collectively would say, here, you see, we told you so. They're now invading the Baltic states. Who knows what's going to happen? But I think that hopefully before any of that happens, the European Union will disintegrate. And then, you know, the Russians have shown that they aren't... how do you call it? They aren't prone to falling for provocations. And when things, you know, when the Ukrainians launched their anti-terror operations, where they started bombing and shelling towns and cities around Donbas, the Russians didn't intervene for 8 years. And, you know, they caused 14,000 casualties. But, you know, it's better than a world war.
Yeah.
Time will tell.
Yeah, time will tell. Comment a little bit about what's going on in the Middle East here. Literally a little bit over a week, you had the White House, Trump, really doing a lot of saber rattling at Iran. Netanyahu was over at the White House again, I want to say a week ago. It looks like he was trying to, you know, position himself to get what he wanted. I'm assuming that was to go into Iran or have a military aggression with Iran. That hasn't happened as of yet, thank God. Who wants a war over there? That's just insane to me. But comment about that, what's going on in the Middle East right now.
So Trump's policy in the Middle East is incomprehensible to me. So much so that it seems unforgivably stupid. And I don't tend to think of his administration as being stupid. You know, they are a lot of things, but even if Trump is, you know, he has his style, he's abrasive, he's impulsive, he doesn't seem to work on he's not like Putin or Lavrov who, you know, carefully weigh every word they say and have a well-formulated strategies for dealing with this and that and then contingencies. Trump, it seems to me, has a mission, but not really a plan. And they're kind of, you know, adjusting their approach as things happen. But, you know, the bombing of Yemen makes no sense whatsoever. The reasons for bombing Yemen make no sense whatsoever. The fact that they could have avoided this, if they just pressured Israel to stop bombing Gaza and to, you know, reinstate humanitarian aid to the people of Gaza, makes you wonder what is really going on. And I think that I imagine that he must be dodging political pressures from the, you know, from the Zionist Jews and from the Christian evangelicals who are fanatically devoted to Israel. And I think that this was confirmed to me by the way that they launched this vicious harangue against Pete Hegseth, apparently because he voted against launching an attack on Iran. And so the reaction was just surreal. It was hysterical. And it's not like he doesn't support poor Israel. He just didn't want to open another war that could have potentially incalculable consequences. And so it seems to me that Trump wants to cut a deal with the Iranians. I think they must understand how risky an attack on Iran would be, and that the United States would almost certainly lose in that scenario. Because, you know, they have a very difficult time with the Houthis, right? Not only are they having a difficult time, but you know, if they continue this way, it's a matter of time before Houthis score a really, you know, they apparently they destroyed one FA-18 fighter jet. That, you know, Houthis said that they downed it. The Americans say that it just kind of rolled off the deck when they were making a turn. Whichever the case is, you know, that's real strain on the troops and on the naval forces in the region. And if they're struggling against Ansar Allah in Yemen, imagine taking on Iran. Both Israel and the U.S. forces, both, you know, the ground military bases and the naval assets would come under fire in a bigger way than probably ever since World War II. And I think that the United States would lose ships, and I think that potentially thousands of sailors would be lost. So that's a very likely outcome. I can't imagine that. See, even if the arch Zionist in the administration might still be willing to take that risk, then you have the whole command and control hierarchy where I think there's a clearer understanding of the potential risks and where you would get pushback from the Pentagon and from the troops that, hey, we don't want to do this. This is crazy. This doesn't make any sense. So even if Pete Hegseth said, okay, let's go, we bomb Iran, I think that lower down ranks would say, sir, this is crazy. We should not be doing this. So I think it's a question of domestic policies more than it is the question of geopolitics. And I think that And then, you know, on the same day when the Trump's team was supposed to be meeting with the Iranians in Oman through the mediation of Omanis, we had the terror attack in Bandar Abbas in the port in Iran, and then we had another one later. So there's this could be the Israelis who are behind this, or it could be the British, you know. So there's obviously not just the Zionists and the Israelis, but also the globalist forces who are stacked against Donald Trump making peace with Iran. So it seems to me that he wants to make a deal with Iran. He doesn't want to take the military route for justifiable reason. But I think that he's facing very, very heavy headwinds against this. So I think that this largely explains the insane policies in the Middle East.
Yeah, no, it is insane, and it's really hard to understand and figure out all of this web that's been woven, and just really projecting what's going to happen. It's nearly impossible, if you would. The only hope and prayer is that cooler heads prevail.
Yes.
Cooler heads prevail. Real quick, we got about maybe 10 minutes left. The economy is obviously slowing with the Trump tariffs, a list of reasons, and that's not to be a negative on Trump tariffs. I do have my own opinions on that, but comment though, the economies are slowing, and it looks like U.S. is already contracting, if you would, headed into recession, or already headed in recession. You made the comment that Germany's had 6 quarters, if you would, of recession or contraction. And it looks like now, and gold's been screaming, and I think that's just due to it sniffing out, gold sniffing, that central banks are going to have to flood the system with money. Comment about that here, just currencies, what's going on economically, why gold is screaming, and what investors should be looking for.
Well, as you might know, I'm a trend follower by both in practice and by conviction. And so she asked me why gold is screaming. I'm aware of the narratives. You know, there's so much fundamental analysis, but my answer is it's screaming because it's screaming.
It's screaming
because it's going up. And, you know, when people see something go up, they say like, hey, you know, this is going up. Let's buy it. We've seen it. With Bitcoin, with Nvidia, with Tesla, with Palladium, with on and on and on. You know, markets move in trends. As far as I'm concerned, there's good reasons why people should allocate their capital to gold, but maybe those same reasons would validate allocating your capital to silver. But we've seen the silver barely moved, right? So I don't know what the reasons are, but I think that the U.S. economy is in a fragile state. So is the Japanese economy, Canadian economy, European economy, British economy, and so on. There's a debt overhang. The central banks are forced to flood liquidity into the system to keep it from seizing up. And this then further exacerbates inflationary pressures. I think that what Trump is doing with tariffs is much, much bigger than just, just to bring in industries back home. I think it's absolutely a choice between two systems, two systems of managing an economy of a nation. And, you know, one of them, This was nicely formulated by Abraham Lincoln's economic advisor Henry Carey in his 1851 book called The Harmony of Interests, where he contrasts two systems. And he says, one is the American system of political economy, and the other one is the British system of free trade. The American system of free of political economy allocates capital into industrialization and development of infrastructure. And in that sense, it makes the economy wealthier, it raises people's standards of living, and it's conducive to peace among nations. Whereas the British free trade system actually preferentially allocates capital to speculation, to blowing up and then bursting asset bubbles, which pretty much functions as a pump that transfers economic wealth, that transfers wealth from those who produce it to those who control the monetary system. And as we have seen the most recent figures, the wealth polarization in the United States is the highest it's ever been. It's higher than it was in the 1920s, and by some margin. And so what you get is you get social tensions, and you get also this permanent war economy. And so it doesn't work. So I think that this is what Trump is trying to change, basically transition the United States off of the British free trade system and back to the American system of political economy, which has made the United States in the last century into the global economic superpower. He said so pretty much explicitly. He said he wanted to make the United States as the global manufacturing powerhouse or superpower, whatever it is, whatever word that he used. Now, obviously, this is provoking a very, very strong pushback from those who most benefited from this free trade system, which is generally the bankers, you know, the top of the banking cartel in the United States and in Europe. But the system is built to break. You know, it always pushes you to war because, you know, the social tensions at home become unbearable. And then you go, you know, try to conquer collateral abroad and then also release the social pressures at home by fighting a war abroad. And that also kind of leads towards fascism and totalitarianism, which is what we see now in the UK and increasingly in Europe. So the tariffs, to my mind, were the opening salvo in that struggle, which in itself is not going to change much. It's already starting to change things on the margins gradually, but I think that the whole transition is going to be such a comprehensive process that these tariffs are just a spark that, you know, the detonator that it ignited the cascade of events that's going to follow. Now, I don't understand why the Trump administration is not communicating this more explicitly so that, you know, they can maintain popular support for these measures, even though they're going to cause some pain in the process. But they're not. And I think that the reason why they're not is because they're all also under fire from their political opposition, who are now, you know, now the new catchword is chaos, you know, chaos, chaos, chaos. Everybody's saying that Trump is creating chaos and everything is chaos. And, you know, if you're gonna take one thing away from this conversation, take the word chaos. But that's the same kind of thing as we've seen, you know, this is extremely dangerous to our democracy. But it is like that, isn't it? Everybody just jumps on board. Do you remember when they were saying that Pete Hegseth, no, J.D. Vance was weird? Everybody was repeating the same thing. And so But the reason why, you know, it's funny, but at the same time, it's serious because it indicates that somewhere there's some Politburo which is giving these directives to people to say, like, okay, we're going with this. This is the new campaign. Chaos. Operation Chaos.
Yeah.
And so they're obviously attacking Trump and his administration in a very vicious way, in a very concerted way, because they want to derail the transition from the free trade system to the American system, because they want to derail the relationship between Russia and the United States. They want to derail peace in Europe, and so on and so forth. And as, I think as a result, they're making the Trump administration appear chaotic, and it's taking away from their credibility. And I think that they should communicate with the American people more effectively. But, you know, maybe it's easier said than done. Because communicating for communication, you also need media, and the media are definitely in the globalist camp.
Right. Well, Alex, you have to leave here soon, but I wanted to do things. You didn't know I was going to do this, but I'm going to say it anyways. Thank you. Thank you. You are probably the most watched videos on my channel. So congratulations. You've really blown up. And to all my viewers and listeners, offline, Alex is a great guy. He's very humble, and he has some of the best insight that I've come across for geopolitics as well as trading. So I want to publicly acknowledge you to that, and you're becoming a friend of mine and somebody I deeply trust for insight. So thank you. If you could give people, I'll put all of this in the show notes below this interview on YouTube, Spotify, as well as Apple. How can people read you, reach out to you to get your services and products?
Well, first of all, Andy, thank you very much. That's very kind of you. Deeply appreciated. People can find me on X. My handle is @NakedHedgy. And then I'm also active on Substack. I have two publications. One is for people who trade and invest. It's a daily trend following newsletter called iSystem Trend Compass. And the other Substack publication is just my personal, where my personal publication called Alex Craner's Substack. The difference between the two is that on the market newsletter, I publish every day, and I only publish on my personal Substack when I have something researched and refined enough that I think, okay, it's good enough to publish. You know, the market newsletter has to go out, and then, you know, it's maybe a little bit, as far as commentary goes, it's a little bit less refined and less thoroughly researched. But at any rate, the market signals get spit out of the model, out of the algorithm. So they're consistent in that sense.
I will put all of that in the show notes below again of this interview on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple. Alex, you are one of the few people that is much more busier than I am. And I'm extremely busy.
Oh, again.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. Thank you for becoming a friend. And I just really enjoy our times together. Just really fantastic insights into geopolitics and really the global economy and trends. So again, thank you for that.
It's my pleasure, Andy. Thank you again.
Take care.